All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. We're diving into a case today
That's a good.
that really gets at the intersection of employment contracts and what happens when someone feels they haven't been paid fairly.
Yeah, exactly.
All that good stuff in here.
So we're looking at Carroll v. Stryker Corporation,
Yeah.
Seventh Circuit, 2011.
All right.
And for everyone listening, this is, especially relevant if you think about contracts, if you're thinking about,
Right.
your future job and compensation.
Yeah, definitely some lessons here.
So to kind of set the stage, we have Matthew Carroll, who was a salesperson working on commission for Stryker,
Okay.
a medical device company,
Got it.
and he ends up suing for unpaid commissions.
Right.
And his argument is, twofold, right? He says, well, there's a state law here that should protect me. And there's also this kind of underlying idea of fairness, quantum merit, unjust enrichment, these equitable concepts. Yeah, he felt he deserved to be paid for the value he brought, regardless of, the exact paperwork, like regardless of what the contract looked like.
Right. So he's saying, look, I did the work.
Right.
I brought value. I deserve to be compensated.
Yeah, exactly. And it gets kind of tricky though, because he was an at-will employee at Stryker, a medical device company, like you said, starting back in 2003. And everything was going fine until 2008 rolled around, implemented a new commission plan. January 2008,
Right.
they rolled out this new plan. And, Carroll, his position was he never really formally signed this new plan.
Yeah.
He just kind of viewed it as a guideline, more or less. And then he keeps working under this new framework, even though he didn't sign.
Right. So he's operating under this 2008 commission plan.
Exactly.
And then April 2008, he gets terminated
Yeah, because he wasn't meeting those sales quotas.
for not hitting his sales targets. And that's when he decides, okay, I'm gonna take Stryker to court.
Yeah, makes sense.
Files his lawsuit in Wisconsin State Court. Alleging that he's owed unpaid wages under the Wisconsin statute,
Okay.
109.03.
Gotcha.
And then he also, as a backup, throws in those equitable arguments.
Yeah, smart move. Always good to have a backup plan in litigation.
Right? Just in case this doesn't work, maybe this will.
Exactly.
But then Stryker, being headquartered in Michigan, they're like, wait a minute,
Right.
we want this in federal court.
Yeah, classic diversity jurisdiction move.
So they remove the case to a federal court.
Exactly. And for those of you listening, diversity jurisdiction basically means a federal court can hear a case when the parties involved are from different states, like in this instance, and the amount in dispute is over a certain threshold, $75,000 to be precise. It's designed to ensure a neutral playing field,
Right. So no home court advantage.
Exactly.
And here's where it gets even more tricky for Carroll, because he later admits that the Wisconsin wage statute he initially relied on, well, it turns out it doesn't actually cover commission sales reps.
Oh, that's a tough break. So that avenue is basically closed off for him.
Yeah, that avenue is closed.
All right.
So he has to rely solely on these ideas of fairness,
Right.
quantum merit, unjust enrichment.
Got it. So it all hinges on those equitable arguments now.
Right. And Stryker comes back and says, hold on, we have an agreement.
Yeah.
We have the 2008 commission plan.
Exactly. And you were working under it.
And if there's a contract, you can't just go around it and say, well, I deserve more based on fairness.
Right. That's their whole point. They're saying, look, there's a contract that dictates how you get paid. You can't just ignore it and claim you're entitled to something else based on these broader fairness principles.
So that's like the heart of the legal battle here, right?
Absolutely. It's about whether those equitable remedies are even an option when a contract already addresses the issue.
Right. And then to add another layer of complexity, Carroll later tries to add a breach of contract claim.
Oh, interesting. So he's switching gears a bit.
But he tries to do it after the deadline has passed.
Yeah, you can't just amend your complaint whenever you feel like it. There are rules, deadlines, procedures.
Right. So now we have a couple of really meaty legal issues here.
Yeah, this is where it gets fun for us law nerds,
All
right?
right. So first we have this question of whether those equitable remedies, are they even available
Right. Can you even consider them?
when there's an express contract that already covers compensation?
Exactly.
We also have this procedural question of whether the district court was right to deny Carroll's request to amend his complaint.
Right. Did they properly shut down his attempt to add that breach of contract claim so late in the game? There are good reasons for those deadlines.
Yeah. And then kind of underlying all of this is the question of, well, did the federal court even have the authority to hear this case to begin with?
Right, that whole diversity jurisdiction thing we talked about. Was the amount Carol was claiming actually enough to meet that threshold to be in federal court?
Right, that $75,000 requirement.
Exactly. So much to unpack here.
Okay, so let's see how the Seventh Circuit dealt with all of this. Starting with, this central question of, can you use these equitable arguments when there's a contract already in place?
Yeah. What did they have to say about that?
So they look at Wisconsin state law and they basically say, look, it's pretty clear here. If you have a valid contract that deals with this specific issue,
Which is how Carol was supposed to be paid.
then generally you can't just go to these fairness
Yeah,
arguments.
the contract's supposed to be the controlling document, right? That's the whole point of having a contract.
Right.
It's interesting, though, because Carol's argument was that he never actually signed the 2008 plan, remember?
Yeah, he just thought of it as a guideline.
Exactly. So how did the court address that?
Well, they went through the elements of contract formation.
Okay, so offer, acceptance, consideration, the classic trio.
Offer, acceptance, and consideration. And they found that the 2008 commission plan, it did form a valid contract.
Okay, so how did they arrive at that conclusion?
Well, Stryker made the offer with the new commission plan. And then, even though Carroll didn't sign it, the court said that his actions, his continuing to work under that plan, amounted to acceptance.
Ah, so they're saying his conduct implied acceptance even without a signature. Interesting.
Right. It's like his actions spoke louder than his lack of signature.
Yeah, that makes sense. So by continuing to work under those terms, he basically signaled, okay, I'm on board with this.
Right. And then the court also found that there was consideration because he was continuing to work in exchange for
I think
compensation,
there's that exchange of value.
as laid out in the plan.
Yeah, gotta have that
They
consideration.
even cited this legal idea that a promise is illusory only if one party assumes no obligation.
So they're emphasizing that both sides, Stryker and Carroll, had responsibilities under this arrangement.
Right. Both sides had skin in the game. So the court basically comes down and says, look, there's a valid contract. And because there's a valid contract, you can't just go around it with these fairness arguments.
Right. They basically said, where there's an enforceable contract, those equitable claims like quantum merit and unjust enrichment are off the table.
Right. And they dismissed Carroll's idea that the plan was just a guideline. They said, no. Your actions show that you are treating it as more than just a guideline.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways.
Okay, so what about Carroll's attempt to amend his complaint and add that breach of contract claim?
Right. What happened with that? Because remember, he tried to do it after the deadline.
Right, he missed the deadline.
Yeah, and courts are pretty strict about those deadlines.
Yeah, and the court was not very sympathetic to his request.
So they upheld the magistrate judge's decision to deny the amendment.
The magistrate judge had said, no, you can't amend it. And the Seventh Circuit agreed.
Okay, so what was their reasoning for shutting that down?
They basically said there was an unjustified delay on Carroll's part.
Makes sense. He waited too long.
And they also talked about the potential prejudice to Stryker if they allowed this late amendment.
Right, because Stryker had been building their defense based on the initial claims.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be fair to suddenly change the game plan so late.
Right. So this, really emphasizes for our listeners how important those deadlines are.
Huge takeaway there. Don't mess around with deadlines in litigation. Federal courts are serious about their procedures.
Right. Okay, let's switch gears and talk about the jurisdiction issue.
Right. Did the federal court even have the power to hear this case in the first place? That's a fundamental question.
So when a case is removed to federal court, there's this thing called the legal certainty test.
Yeah, that comes into play when we're dealing with diversity jurisdiction, like in this case.
Right. So Stryker, the party that moved the case, they had to show that the amount in controversy, how much money was at stake, was likely more than $75,000.
Yeah, they have to demonstrate that it's more likely than not that the potential damages reach that jurisdictional minimum. It's like a first hurdle they have to clear.
So more likely than not. And once they do that, then the burden shifts to the other party, to Carroll, to try to show that it's not more than $75,000.
Exactly. It becomes a bit of a back and forth, with each side trying to meet their respective burdens of proof.
But Carroll has to demonstrate this to a legal certainty.
Right, which is a much tougher standard than simply showing it's not more likely than not. It's a very high bar to clear.
And remember, at this point, Carroll is only relying on those equitable claims.
Right, because that Wisconsin wage statute was no longer an option for him.
Right. So the court looks at the evidence and says, Well, even if we focus just on what he could potentially get under those equitable theories, unjust enrichment or quantum merit, Carroll hasn't given us enough proof to definitively say his claims are worth less than $75,000.
So he didn't meet that legal certainty standard to knock it out of federal court.
Right. He just didn't provide enough evidence to say for sure that his claim fell below that threshold.
Interesting. So what was the final verdict on the jurisdiction issue?
The court said, look, Stryker met their initial burden, and Carroll didn't do enough to overcome that and prove to a legal certainty that the amount wasn't enough for federal court.
So federal court it is.
So they said, yeah, this case belongs in federal court.
Got it. Makes sense. And you mentioned earlier that there were some key quotes from the court's decision that really captured the essence of the legal principles at play.
Yeah, yeah. So one that we already talked about a bit is, where there's an enforceable contract, quantum merit and unjust enrichment are unavailable.
Right. Super clear and to the point. That sums up the preclusion doctrine perfectly in this context.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a contract, those equitable remedies are out.
Right. And then there's this other quote about consideration. A promise is illusory only if one party assumes no obligation.
Yeah, that one reinforces why the court viewed that 2008 commission plan as a binding agreement. Because both Stryker and Carroll had obligations under it. It wasn't just one-sided.
Right, right.
And for our listeners who are maybe trying to connect this to bigger legal concepts, this case is a great example of the preclusion doctrine in action.
Definitely. It shows how a valid contract trumps those equitable remedies that might otherwise be available.
Right. And then there's the whole jurisdiction piece. We saw how that two-part test works when a case is moved from state to federal court.
Exactly. The removing party has to show it's more likely than not that the amount is there. And then the other party has to prove, to a legal certainty, that it's not.
And then finally, Carroll's failed attempt to amend his complaint.
Yeah, what a lesson there.
That really highlights the importance of following procedural rules and those deadlines in federal court.
Seriously, you can't just make changes whenever you want. You have to show good cause for any delay and prove that the change won't unfairly harm the other side.
Right. So what are the big takeaways here? What should people listening keep in mind from this case?
Well, I think for anyone working on commission, or really in any employment situation, this case shows that the terms of your compensation, especially if they're laid out in a plan, are enforceable.
Yeah, even if you're an at-will employee.
Exactly. It highlights how important it is for both employers and employees to be on the same page about compensation from the get-go. Clear communication, well-defined agreements, those are key.
And what about for folks who might end up in court one day?
Well, as we saw with Carroll's attempt to amend his complaint, you got to be on top of those deadlines. Federal courts don't mess around with procedure. And from the outset, be ready to address that jurisdiction question head on. Have your arguments and evidence ready to go.
Right. So the bottom line is, even if you haven't signed a contract, if you're acting like it's in place, the court might treat it as a valid contract.
Absolutely. Your actions can create a binding agreement, even without a signature. And once that contract exists, you can't just rely on fairness arguments to get around it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, knowing the rules of the game, those procedural deadlines and jurisdiction requirements, that's crucial if you want to navigate the legal system effectively.
Yeah, really important stuff. So I guess the final thought for everyone listening is, think about situations where your actions might be creating an agreement even if you haven't signed anything.
Yeah, exactly. And what could the consequences be? Because as we saw in Carroll, those implied agreements can have real legal teeth.
Absolutely. Really great points. Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you next time.
See ya.